When it finally happened, it was as predictable as it was depressing. But what does the return of George Galloway mean for British politics and its troubled left?
The George Galloway question.
A stunning Commons comeback by George Galloway. Keir Starmer's worst nightmare.
Keir Starmer, this is for Gaza. You have paid, and you will pay, a high price for the role that you have played in enabling, encouraging, and covering for the catastrophe presently going on in occupied Palestine in the Gaza Strip.
And it is beyond alarming that last night the Rochdale by-election returned a candidate who dismisses the horror of what happened on October the 7th, who glorifies Hezbollah and is endorsed by Nick Griffin, the racist former leader of the BNP.
Hello and welcome to the Another Europe is Possible podcast with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host Luke Cooper. We're joined today by the activist and writer Michael Chesson, economist, writer, and council member of the Progressive Economy Forum, James Medway. This conversation has previous. On Friday the 1st of March, the nation still reeling, sort of, from the election of George Galloway, Michael wrote an opinion column in The Guardian, we'll link in the show notes, describing the forces he saw at play in Rochdale and what those ramifications were for left-wing activists everywhere. James disagreed on X, formerly Twitter. Luke understood the kernel of their disagreement and weighed in on Michael's side. I did not wholly understand it, but I got the spidey sense that anyone would get who spent long enough minutely yet importantly clashing with their close allies. George Galloway, forgive me, I'm editorialising, is part morbid symptom, part synecdoche of a larger conversation about strategies, priorities, values, pitfalls and traps on the left. But what does he represent? What is the source of his popularity and what lessons can we draw from it?
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
So James and Michael, welcome to this show. Rarely has a small exchange on Twitter produced such a verbose introduction to a podcast. So lovely to see you. How are you both doing?
Very well, thank you, Luke. And nice to be talking to you as well.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back as well. And nice to talk to you.
Good, good. Let's start then with getting a thumbnail description on what we think of George Galloway. We've both been on the left a little while. So he's been a recurring feature of that history. Let's start with you, James. George Galloway, politician, thinker, man. Where do you situate him today?
That's quite possibly an invitation to trouble or a, you know, a libel writ or something, if you're not careful. At least one part of that question. The way in which George Galloway gets treated as a sort of uniquely awful presence in British political life is a little overcooked. But we can come back to the many and varied problems, I think, with what he's doing. I should say, by the way, there's a substantial amount of fundamental agreement between me and Michael on like what the problems are with what George Galloway is doing. It is not good to have somebody in the position that he's in, like repeating the sort of, it's not even a nod and wink and some of the transphobia stuff. But then again, it's not good to have Wes Streeting doing that sort of thing either. And he's not treated in quite the same sort of dramatic fashion that George Galloway gets done. But if we're going to try and sort of think about his, George Galloway's career, and it really does stretch it, what, 40, maybe 50 years now since he first got elected. It's a really long time. I think his own self-description actually captures an important part of the truth, which is that when he says, and he does still describe himself as, you know, a sort of traditional social democratic Labour person, and then certainly back in the day he'd say, oh, but the Labour Party moved away from me, with also a long-standing interest in the Middle East, and as he would see it, the cause of sort of national liberation in the Middle East against imperialism, against colonialism. That, I think, captures an important part of the truth about what he thinks he's doing and his own politics, and also a large part of his kind of personal appeal, which is that this is now a very long history as a campaigner, specifically around Middle Eastern issues. Most obviously, I think for a large number of people, where he really made his name in this country was in opposition to the Second Iraq War, and now, of course, over Palestine. And importantly, known for as somebody who stands up for this. And then alongside that, I think, is his own willingness to talk like a sort of traditional Labour politician, and to do so with a degree of eloquence. And I think all sides would accept that he is a very gifted orator and very sharp sort of debater, somebody who's combative in interviews in a way that has a lot of appeal to a large number of people out there who are otherwise, and this is, I think, where we get onto the Rochdale by-election and what he's done in recent years, otherwise deeply disaffected with the political system. In the opinion poll that the Financial Times was reporting on last week, that 12% of people would express trust in the political parties in Britain. I mean, in some sense, I'm kind of astonished it's that high. I mean, it's nice to have these 12% like happy people who are thinking things are chugging along well and the parties really represent something meaningful and Westminster works and the politicians in there are really looking out for the public good. But George Galloway is tapping very directly into that. And I think this is where what has happened over the last decade, or more than a decade actually, where his version of tapping into that disaffection has got him to do something that looks, actually, I'm going to make the direct comparison, it looks like a kind of triangulation of the 1990s, where you say, okay, I'm on the left, but now I'm going to try and talk to the right. And so you go off in this sort of weird diagonal direction, which in his case, I think has led him to say some things that would put him beyond the pale on the left. If I think about his comments on Julian Assange, I mean, it's a while ago now. If I think about some of the other ways he's presented himself, if I think about how his political vehicle, Workers' Party of Britain, and perhaps we can come back to whether that's sort of a meaningful organisation and what the left might want to do with this. But the way that this talks about, that kind of anti-woke rhetoric that it taps into, I think that has led him in the direction which is not directly helpful to the left, to put it bluntly. And as I said at the start, I think it's something that me and Michael both fundamentally agree on. I think if I'm going to leap ahead slightly and say what the disagreement is, it's like, what does all of this represent and what does the election in Rochdale represent and what are the conclusions we draw from that? And that, I think, is probably where our disagreement stands.
Great. Well, let's come back to that. Michael, James has very helpfully reminded us that this podcast is made in the UK in the context of UK defamation law. Do keep that in mind when describing George Galloway's political trajectory and politics today. And where would you put him?
Yeah, Luke knows me too well. I need that warning. I agree with James that what Galloway represents, there's a large amount of agreement here. Sort of to add to what James has said, I mean, Galloway sort of, certainly for a certain generation of people, certainly my generation, who kind of came of age around the Iraq War. I mean, I was only 14 in 2003, but at that time, George Galloway was a pretty big political figure. When he was expelled from the Labour Party, there were all sorts wrong with George Galloway's politics then, and you could see them. What was wrong with George Galloway's politics then? Slightly hilarious anecdote. I still own a Respect mug. Well, my dad still owns a Respect mug from the time when I first went to see George Galloway speak at a public meeting back in the days, just shortly after the Iraq War. And at that point, you could kind of pitch George Galloway as on the left. He was a problematic version of the left. And George Galloway of that era, or just thereafter, was an apologetic supporter of Assad, made some pretty appalling comments about sexual violence and Julian Assange, as James has already alluded to. But he was the man who took on the American Senate famously in that famous session, kind of positioned himself as an anti-war figure. I think the George Galloway that we see of today is fundamentally not the same person. And I think it's important to understand what the kind of, we could call it the Brexit moment, but actually, of course, it's a much broader international moment than that, has kind of allowed this kind of red-brown, you might characterise it, and I don't want to kind of die in a ditch over that definition, butterfly to emerge from its chrysalis, where George Galloway has moved pretty much decidedly away from the left as we would know it. I think essentially George Galloway has become something quite different. But I think now, if you can look at that in two ways. One is kind of organisationally, the kind of people who carried George Galloway's bags, as it were, around the anti-war period were the Socialist Workers' Party, an organisation, you may have criticisms of them, I certainly do, but an organisation fundamentally on the left, and internal politics aside, on generally speaking, the kind of progressive side of the culture war as well, ended up having his bags carried, at least during the formation of the Workers' Party of Britain, the vehicle that he now leads, by this kind of tiny Stalinist group, Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, who are openly Stalinist and who really as much about social conservatism as they are about anything else. George Galloway has been publicly photographed hanging out with Steve Bannon. He is openly a pro-law and order candidate. I mean, the kind of phrase that sums him up in his current incarnation is "for the workers, not the wokers," which I think is just such a fantastically glib embodiment of what he tries to represent. And kind of by 2021, you'd seen Galloway move away from anything that could be described as a left project to such an extent that his main project was something called All for Unity, where he stood in the Scottish elections of 2021 trying to bring together all the unionist forces in Scottish politics. And his main allies were basically Tories and UKIP. Partly that's about his kind of self-promotion, but actually a lot of that is about his politics changing. There's a reason why Nick Griffin has endorsed him in that constituency, and there's a reason why, when questioned on the Today programme, Chris Williamson, the deputy leader of the Workers' Party of Britain, you know, didn't distance himself from that. There's this sort of temptation, I think, on some parts of the left, with some figures on the left, and indeed in the centre as well, to kind of look at the Brexit moment and the global moment around it as this moment of fundamental realignment where the coordinates of left and right get blurred and changed up and so on. And I'm actually quite conservative on that. I don't necessarily think that the fundamental coordinates of left and right change and that, you know, we need to completely reassess class politics or whatever. And I think going down that rabbit hole can sometimes lead your politics to become quite distorted and strange. But I think subjectively for George Galloway, what has happened over the last decade has changed his political project and what it represents. And I think we need to reassess him on that basis and look kind of quite squarely at what he is. And glibly, a lot of the time during the Brexit period, you would always hear this term red-brown being thrown around, where you had this kind of politics of the pro-Brexit far right that kind of ended up dipping its toes in British nationalism. Some of that was misplaced. But I think when you look at Galloway, there is a much better case for that, is what he represents. So I don't think that he is a unique evil. I think that a lot of what the British establishment is doing is more dangerous. And I don't necessarily think we're going to see some kind of Galloway electoral surge where the Workers' Party of Britain takes a load of seats. It's not completely out of the question, but it's probably not going to happen. But nonetheless, the presence of that politics on the scene presents some very real dangers. Its effect on society and shaping politics, but also its effect internally within the left. The left is in a place now where industrially there's a lot going on, or has been a lot going on, but politically feels very lost. And there's a lot of human material from the period of the Corbyn era who are kind of looking around for somewhere to go. And I think it is incumbent upon those of us who understand what George Galloway represents and what his political project is to send the clear message to everyone who is willing to listen to us that he is not the guy and not the project that we should be following.
I just want to add two things to that. Firstly, I think the entry to Bannonish hard right politics via the language of the left for Galloway was always misogyny. And, you know, he ran that incredibly sexist campaign against Naz Shah in 2015. But the way he talked about women, even back as far as the Stop the War movement, even back as far as to the early noughties, was always really contemptuous. The way he wrote about women, the way he described, everybody was a kind of telly dolly to him. He's kind of really dripping with misogyny. And I'm going to come off like women don't count argument, but the left generally has this very high tolerance for a kind of casual sexism because it sounds authentic politics of the past. But it is actually very authoritarian, and you can kind of see the blueprint for what became a very authoritarian politics in the casual scorn he poured against any female opponent. And secondly, it's an open goal, George Galloway, because the attacks on him that have come from the kind of mainstream politics are that he's an extremist. I'm doing air quotes around that. We're sort of hedging between also finding him extreme, but for other reasons, between seeing what he's trying to do as distinct from what he says he's trying to do, and between not finding the things that other people call extreme all that extreme. You know, it's like sometimes he could sound like a Mick Lynch character, and other times he could sound like a Nick Griffin character. And in not kind of saying clearly where we situate him, we just end up getting railroaded by arguments that we wouldn't necessarily agree with.
Yeah, I agree with that. I suppose the other thing to add into all of this is views on international politics, international relations, let's say. With my LSE Ukraine team hat on, I have to point out that he's a big fan of Vladimir Putin and his invasion of Ukraine. In advance of his recent interview with Tucker Carlson, Galloway anticipated that it would show the world that he was not Vlad the Mad or bad, and that they have been lied about him. This was proved to be a somewhat unfortunate comment, given that Putin's response to Tucker Carlson's first question was a 30-minute monologue, which was completely mad, about Russian history and the non-existence of Ukraine as a nation. And he's denied the Bucha massacre and other such things. So I think he's a big figure in British domestic politics, but these things are all connected, and there is this Russian disinformation landscape that has a lot of appeal, you know, in stretching into the global south as well, where Galloway is able to situate himself, having worked for Russia Today, having worked for Press TV. And I think this is part of that global authoritarian mix too. And of course, the threat from authoritarianism, as we know too well, is not just a external problem that we need to be protected from with, you know, weapons and defense against Russia and so on. It's something that's happening in Britain and the United States too, obviously. And we've discussed it on this show a lot, but this is all still part of the mix. Now, James, you've now been subjected to quite a bit of George Galloway critique. And as you said at the beginning, there's lots of areas of agreement here. So how in all of this context would you sort of situate the Rochdale by-election as an event in British politics?
There's several things to pull out of that, but I think you're right, Luke, to sort of shift the focus away from George Galloway. In a sense, he's not the most interesting thing about the Rochdale by-election. That's probably the starting point on it. I don't think he'd have won the thumping victory, or another candidate would have won that kind of thumping victory, because he did not bring, that other candidate would not have brought specifically what George Galloway did, which is that particular history of campaigning and a sort of personal notoriety and a personal sort of set of talents and his ability to work in by-elections in these circumstances, right? So contributed to the vote to have him there, but it is not the reason for the vote. And I want to come back to that, because I think there's a degree to which the political strategy that George Galloway is following, there's a degree to which it can be overstated that this is actually something other people can follow. That you can start to see some of this across Europe, and I'll come back to this point. I mean, by the way, one minor thing, he's already kind of fallen out with his more obviously left-wing bag carriers. The Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, actually split with the Workers' Party of Britain a few months ago over, it's not entirely clear what, although real heads on the left will know that the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, also split with the Socialist Labour Party after falling out with its leader, Arthur Scargill, probably 20 years ago now. He's kind of lost that sort of organisational relationship, such as it was. I don't think it makes any meaningful difference to the politics of the WPB in the way that the split with the Socialist Workers Party did sort of shape what the politics of Respect were. And I don't particularly want to rehearse the arguments around the split with the Respect back in the day. Although, well, it has to be said, George Galloway and the people around him had a point that actually, if you wanted to run an electoral organisation, you needed a commitment to doing electoral politics, and that shapes what you have to do as an organisation. And that to have the SWP operating as a sort of permanently independent, not very committed, because most members of the SWP weren't really committed to Respect. And there was sort of a dispute in the leadership of the SWP about it that was not made apparent until some years later. This disrupted what Respect was doing, but that's, you know, 20 years ago now. So I think we can sort of safely park that, because I think a great deal has changed. I think it's absolutely right to say that George Galloway's particular version of what you do in circumstances where you're outside of the major parties, where there is clearly a lot of flux in politics and political associations and political loyalties and who people will vote for, how you deal with that does have a sort of impact on your personal politics and where you end up and where you can plausibly go from there. Now, does that mean it's the sort of incipient peel of a kind of red-brown politics, as Michael called it, across Europe? I kind of have my doubts, or at least I think we have to be a bit careful around what that means, because you can find versions of this, potentially, or things you might want to describe as sort of wandering in a similar direction. Sarah Wagenknecht in Germany, her association is polling around 8% in the polls, which is pretty significant for something that's set up really not that long ago. But the striking feature about it, again, is that the degree to which this is a personal vehicle. I mean, literally in this case, it's actually sort of named after her as a way to sort of generate publicity and the rest of it. That there is something that can be tapped into. Matthew Goodman, who, you know, started out as a researcher of UKIP, you know, stare long enough into the abyss moment as really...
Could be quite a few few people, James, to be fair.
Yeah, it's true, actually. That's who I was thinking of. He's the one who, because it was quite a good book he wrote on UKIP with Rob Ford, I think, back in the day.
Rob Ford, yeah. Poor Rob Ford, the co-author of that perfectly okay book.
I know. It's but there we go. You can't, you know, you're collaborators can wander off in all sorts of different directions. But yes, he's been staring into the abyss, and the abyss has well and truly stared back at him. But he insists that there's this magic point you can get to, which is sort of economically radical and socially conservative. And if you can look at George Galloway or Sarah Vaughan-Ecton, you might think, yes, that can hang together. But the degree to which it hinges on personality with that particular history, the way in which it's quite likely that George Galloway is the only person that can make the politics that's on offer, not just in Rochdale, or that he was offering in Rochdale and in Batley. And by the way, he didn't win that. And it was exactly the same sort of run through the politics on there. It was, you know, the trustees in Gaza that were decisive here. He is the only person who can really make that work. That it depends on having this personality to actually pull together what end up being two contradictory elements. Not because rationally the left must think this and the right must think that, but more because the coalition you're trying to build will not put up with and not tolerate other parts of what you're saying unless you have somebody in the middle that can glue all that together. You either have a powerful party and a party history that can make this work. So that, for instance, if the Labour Party, as it is doing now and as it has done in the past, says, OK, we want to sort of offer some economic reforms in some sense. Let's bring in a minimum wage. Let's increase spending in the NHS. But we're also going to clamp down on asylum seekers. The Labour Party can make that work because it's a huge organisation with this big history that's going to be in government at some point, has been in government in the past. Lots and lots of people sign up to it. Hundreds of thousands of members, millions of voters. You can do that. On a very much smaller scale, that operation, potentially you can perform it if you're somebody who has a clearly identified history, is well known, and you can sort of rely on a personal trust to make that hold together. And that, I think, is how red-brown politics in that sense is operating. The real problem, I think, comes in the other direction, which is when you get the brown trying to be red. And this is something that Front National, now National Rally in France, and Marine Le Pen's organization have done, I think, most effectively in Europe, which is actually to start off, I mean, quite overtly in the case of Front National, as a coming out of the fascist tradition, a deliberate relationship to that form of politics, which then presents itself in this sort of pro-worker and heavy air quotes around that. That, I think, tends to work better because it's a gloss, and it's a gloss fascists have always used. I mean, look at what did the National Socialists call themselves? You know, clues in the name, right? And it's a gloss they've always used. I don't think that's what's happening with these sort of left-wing characters or characters from the left, wherever they're positioning themselves now, doing the same thing. I don't think it works in the same way because the underlying politics don't work in the same way. That coalition of support you need to build is really hard to sustain. So final bit in this, I think, is what does this tell you about what the left should be doing? Is it really a challenge to the left to have this politics around? Because I think what you're going to see is a lot of people trying to do a kind of Toy Town Galloway, where you might well say, well, hang on, if that politics is working there and it produces results, we can reproduce it elsewhere. That you'll get Workers of Party of Britain candidates trying to do something similar, but they're not going to be candidates arriving with that national platform that Galloway has, that particular history he has, personal talents that he has, be honest about this, that he brings to this, and it's not going to work, and it's just a bit of a dead end to follow. It isn't something that hangs together. Now, you don't want to be complacent about this because it is disruptive, it is bad, it does get in the way of what is a proper strategy in relation for the left to what is happening at the minute. Possibly the nub of my disagreement with Michael, which is that I think the left in general has to be very careful. Not just very careful, I think it's a sort of necessity, particularly at this point in time, for us to look like and to actually be the kind of anti-systemic candidates, the anti-systemic people. In other words, not somebody who is easily identified, not a group of people who are easily identified with what is evidently a kind of Westminster system, let's call it that, that is rapidly losing. It is in a worse state now in terms of the public support and faith in that system. And you do not want to be identified with that. You do not want to be identified with the establishment. You do not want to be identified with failing centre. Now, the sort of marching off, the anti-woke stuff is used as a sort of easy route to try and make yourself look a bit more anti-establishment. There are better ways to do this. There are ways to do this that don't involve dipping your toes or starting to swim even in those sort of waters. But I think the starting point is, what is that strategic orientation you have as a left? How do you ensure that you are anti-systemic? How do you make what you're saying obviously a break with what is the failing political centre at this point in time. And that, I think, is where the real challenge lies with Galloway. One that is reinforced, I would say, by the Prime Minister. I mean, this is sort of ludicrous, but it's also frightening. The Prime Minister's immediate response to a by-election result, that near hysterical speech, incoherent, really, outside number 10 Downing Street on the sort of evening afterwards. I mean, that was alarming. News that Prevent is going to be expanded to cover people who might call themselves socialists or communists, for example, is alarming. The moves that are already in place on the restriction of the right to protest is alarming. That is the challenge, I think, to take on, far more so than George Galloway. I think exactly as Zoe said, is in this case a symptom rather more than he is the most pressing danger we face.
So I want to go into Westminster and the response and what the pitfalls are for Labour here. Just quickly, two glossary questions. First, tell me what bag carriers means.
It sounds patronising. It means that you are, you know, often labelled as an aide or advisor, but all you're really doing is carrying someone's bag and for them as they go around to political meetings and do their speeches.
When Michael was the national organiser for Another Europe Is Possible, he was your bag carrier, Zoe.
Absolutely right.
The way both of you are using it, it kind of connotes something.
Well, the kind of standard way that you would describe this across much of the left in Europe would be which group animates your project. Very often you'll have this kind of big organisation like the Workers' Party of Britain or the Respect Coalition, but at the core of that, even if it's not the same as the political leadership, what you need is a tightly organised activist army. It very often, in points on the left, that has come from a sort of a left organisation. And then I guess bag carrier, semi-derogatory term that we're using, which is where it relates to a specific leader.
And Red Brown, that's socialist fascist, right?
Yeah, exactly. To some degree, though, let's call it socialist meet right populist for the purposes of UK defamation law. Galloway is just basically someone who's determined to prove the horseshoe theory of politics correct, right? That, you know, basically the left becomes the right and vice versa.
Yeah. OK, so to move on to Westminster and the impact this result has had, we've got Sunak making this, as you say, quite hysterical speech about extremism. He's trying to create an untouchable class in politics, in which Galloway provides him with quite a useful figurehead. But the way he's getting to untouchable class is via any support for Gaza is anti-Semitic by definition. Anti-Semitism is a poison in our land. Anybody who's kind of openly against bombardment of Gaza is therefore a kind of toxic force in British politics. This, so far, I haven't seen any decent and coherent Labour response to that. Has anybody else seen that? And what do we think Labour should be saying?
I think where has the Labour position gone? So I suppose it started from a very Atlanticist position, i.e., you know, whatever the Biden administration does, we need to follow. And it comes from this mindset that they're going to be prime minister next year and they need to be folded into this intergovernmental space of UK foreign policy making where you just align with the US position. As time has moved on, that's obviously extremely contentious, not only amongst their own base, but in UK public opinion in general, which is, I guess, an interesting illustration of how we don't always follow the United States on these questions, although support for Palestine is growing in the US public opinion too. It's an interesting contrast that our political elite tend to take or, you know, err in the direction of a pro-Israeli stance, but on public opinion, and I think anecdotally with, you know, apolitical members of my family, I find this quite a lot over the last few months as well. I mean, people just watch the war crimes being committed on their television, and sure, they might not be framed in a particularly pro-Palestinian way, but they take a position that clearly this isn't going to work. It brings echoes of the war on terror, which was a disaster and a failure, and that there should be an immediate ceasefire. So that's put Labour in a position where it's had to adapt to that. And within that mix, of course, the fact that Muslim voters will overwhelmingly supported Labour in the last election and are concentrated in some particularly important seats for them, safe Labour seats, you know, becomes a factor for their coalition too.
And Michael, do you see any sign of Labour pivoting or even thinking that hard about Gaza?
I think Labour under Starmer has cleaved pretty closely to the government position, and the government position is trailing the American position. And so, I mean, even when in late February you got the Labour Party turning towards an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, when there were those votes in Parliament where there was all sorts of kerfuffle, which, to be honest, is too dull a parliamentary moment to go into in many ways. I mean, it wasn't particularly good, but nonetheless, I think is exactly the kind of storm in a teacup. But even that motion that Labour put down then and said, oh, we know we've shifted our position, even then an immediate humanitarian ceasefire was caveated with basically saying, we call for an humanitarian ceasefire, but by the way, obviously that can only happen when all of Israel's war aims are met. You've essentially got to bring down Hamas and destroy Hamas in order for that to kind of be binding. So it was this kind of pretty fence-sitting position. No, I don't think that Labour is thinking very hard about Gaza. It, in a way, its latest kind of turn was to try to look more serious than the ceasefire. You know, the line of the leadership was, well, you know, you're talking about a ceasefire, but we're talking about the solutions for the future and the two-state solution and so on. And all of that is slightly preposterous. The thing that you need to do right now is call for an end to what could very well be a genocide. And if you're kind of not willing to do that, the rest of your position kind of doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And also think that some of the discussions around formulations had terrible, haunting echoes of the discussions over Brexit, where people would argue over formulations that were substantively not really very different. James, could I just ask you, moving maybe away from Gaza towards where the Labour leadership is situating itself in general? I mean, we've obviously just had the budget. They seem to be going into election that now appears to be likely to happen later this year in this kind of very austerian macroeconomic space. Is that sustainable? What's your read of their take on the budget, like maxing out the credit card, all this kind of stuff? Where are they going, and what do you think we can expect if they do win the election?
Well, it's I mean, you can expect more of the same in both senses there. I mean, look, the Starmer and the Labour leadership's immediate response to Rishi Sunak and in his speech and the sort of vague threats it contained was basically to welcome it and to say, yes, we'll support the government on this. They have made a point of being seen to be in lockstep with the government on the more sort of repressive legislation that's gone through and supported this sort of authoritarian lurch. It's been in train for a while, but you can see it picking up on restrictions of the right of protest and now what looks like restrictions on, you know, what you're allowed to argue for in public spaces and things. I mean, this is the ominous part of what Rishi Sunak was suggesting on Friday, and that may yet actually start to turn into policy shifts and meaningful changes in what the government does. That's where they're positioned on this very deliberately. And it's the same thing with the economic policy, that once you start to see yourself, and fundamentally this is the sort of Starmer leadership strategy by this point, is to see yourself as the competent managers of the system as it is, that you're not there to make any fundamental reforms to it or even serious reforms to it. You're there to make sure that something is basically okay is now going to be run properly by the sensible people. You end up doing things like having to repeat some of the nonsense that this system of economic governance produces, which is the credit card is maxed out, there is no national credit card, or, you know, I suspect we might find the cupboard is bare later on if they're really going to recycle the greatest hits from the late 2000s, early 2010 George Osborne playbook. That's where you find yourself going, that you're the sensible managers of a system that's basically deeply stupid, that you're doing things that are actively harmful and damaging, and this is sawing off the branch that you're sitting on. This is the doom loop of notoriety, where you are trapped forever with low investment, an economy that doesn't work for most people, and a system that sits at the top of it, based around the Treasury and the Bank of England, that says we can't really do anything about it, because to do anything about low investment would be really expensive and we can't afford to make any investment because the system's not working properly, and therefore there's no money, but there's no money because there's no investment, and here's the doom loop. And you end up just justifying sets of things that fundamentally do not work. Now, the great contrast between now and 1997, which is, I was going back a bit, it's the last time Labour would have entered office if they win the next election, and let's assume they will. I mean, first of all, just internally, like New Labour, whatever dismissals we might want to make of it today, and they'll pop on the left at the time, they had a coherent story. They put a great deal of thought into what they were doing. They had a set of things they wanted to achieve. If you look at Tony Blair's first term in office, he actually did some stuff, like the Scottish Parliament is a huge constitutional shift. It's doing something. Labour today is rejecting even the Gordon Brown proposals on the constitution. You notice Mandelson talking up that they're not going to do anything with the House of Lords now. After a few years, they did actually increase spending on the NHS. Now, the key to this, NHS and education and various other things, they put the NHS back in its feet. They sorted out the education. The school system in this country was better than it used to be because Labour was in government. They spent some money on it. They did some things, and they had a story to tell and a genuinely popular leader. And they had an enormous economic boom that was just getting going from the mid-1990s, based on sand, as it turned out, and we're still living with the consequences of this, but it was there. Labour now has none of this. It also has the addition of geopolitical instability in a way that didn't exist in the mid-1990s, and climate change, which was there, but its impacts are not being felt in quite the same way. So none of this is in place, and they're going to wander into office thinking they can just sort of manage things, make a few tweaks. They lack even the ambition of New Labour for all the sort of cosplay New Labour stuff that they do, and they're in a situation that is not even as favourable. And meanwhile, they're just sticking to a system that is at least since the 2008 crisis. And that's really, I think, where this sort of gap between what Westminster thinks it's doing and what the public thinks should be done started to open up. That gap is wider now than it used to be. And their version of trying to close it is to insist that it cannot be closed. It should not be closed. This is what the meaning of Starmer saying, we support the government on this move against extremism, comes down to. And we're going to ignore it and just carry on. I mean, this looks like a recipe for disaster in government, for a government that fails even on its own terms, which are already pretty limited. This has the whiff of, you know, 1974 to 79 rather more than 1997 to 2010, let's say.
Absolutely right. And I think, where does that lead us? Where does Labour failing in government lead us? I mean, I think it's worth being a little bit, showing humility is, you know, I mean, I remember writing articles and making interventions and saying Starmer will need the left in order to win in 2024 or 2025 or whenever it is. And gradually that became untrue, and he can win without us. He can win when essentially just sort of crushing us under his sandal, effectively. But that leads us to an even worse situation where he fails in government. The beneficiaries of that are going to be the new nationalist right, and the new nationalist right probably under some kind of rightward moving Conservative Party or a force to the right of that. In a sense, that's where kind of moment we're in, and the meaning of George Galloway isn't really about George Galloway, and it isn't really about the Rochdale by-election. What Galloway offers to do, and James is absolutely right to say that the people you've really got to watch out of are the brown masquerading as the red rather than the red masquerading as the brown. But nonetheless, what Galloway's politics represents is an opportunity for the nationalist right to capture a political space in a much more hegemonic way, where even the anti-systemic parts of those bits of the left that can break through, or those bits of that some people regard as the left, as I say, I wouldn't place George Galloway on the left, but that even those parts that can break through on an anti-systemic basis themselves share the politics of the new far right. And so the problem that Galloway presents us with on the left is precisely that the anti-systemic break from Starmerism has happened over an issue, primarily over the issue of Gaza, over rebellion against Gaza, but it's happening absolutely not on our terms, and led by, I think, the worst possible person. I mean, it's hard to think of a project that is a worse tribune for either the Palestinian cause or the left. Maybe where James and I disagree, I don't want to caricature what James is saying, is that I think we're in danger of vigorously agreeing with each other in the round. I think we have to be able to critique and attack what George Galloway represents and the politics that George Galloway represents, that kind of for the workers, not the wokers politics, and present an anti-systemic alternative. And I think it's particularly important when you have an audience within the left, when there is this audience for the anti-systemic left politics over Gaza that Galloway represents. We do need to set out decided and deliberate markers between his lot and the rest of the left.
What you're saying, to kind of meld those points, James, the first term of the Labour government will be a disaster. Michael, that will usher in a new ethno-nationalist right, is reminding me a lot of Neil Lawson and Compass's line. Is there a sense of renewal on the kind of momentum, Corbyn curious, Green curious left, where across the piece, everybody to the left of what is quite a right-wing Labour Party is having a kind of moment of intellectual renewal, but also activist renewal and cooperating better? Do you see any signs of that? James first.
I think so. I mean, I've been a bit of an external observer, been out of the country for a while, but from what you pick up on, from what you see in talking to people and seeing online, it feels like that. It's everywhere Gaza has been decisive in some sense. And I think this has created something that, mostly because of that stupid interview that Keir Starmer did, that is just going to be very, very hard for Labour to get out of now. It sort of fundamentally shifted the terrain. There's a sort of moral value, very reasonably, that people attach to this, that is not simply overcome by saying, oh, well, politically, we're going to have to put up with X, Y, or Z. That, I think, is really fundamental to how a bunch of people are thinking about the world now. And I suspect things will move quite rapidly now that the election is looming. And whatever else may have happened, George Galloway has demonstrated that there are a very large number of deeply disaffected people out there who are open to sort of different messages. So I suspect this will move quite rapidly. I mean, don't underestimate the scale of the victory. I mean, to get more than double the votes of the two main parties, even in a by-election, is like pretty dramatic. So let's not underestimate that. By the way, I should say, just to come back to something, Nick Griffin also made a noise about supporting Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, this is something that Nick Griffin, who is a long-standing fascist, that's something I'm definitely allowed to say, it's something that he does. He kind of jangles his keys and a bunch of people get excited about it. He does it every time, and it's a way for him to suddenly be trending on Twitter. This has been to suddenly make himself relevant. So let's not read too much into that particular recommendation. But what it leaves us, who are actually on the left and thinking about what to do next, is this deep challenge, I think, where, yes, Labour are likely to win on the basis of something that is a negative rejection of the Conservative Party, not a positive vote in most cases for what they're actually going to offer. I mean, you might be able to pull out the proverbial rabbit from the hat in the manifesto, but all signs do not point towards this, let's be honest. And that creates a real difficulty or a political challenge for anybody on the left about what to do next. Now, my own thinking in this is that it is likely that Labour would get into office before there's any significant movement in a way that's open to the left, away from Labour. What seems to be happening is that this is already happening even before they're in office. Now, there are all sorts of other forces out there who want to take advantage of this. Reform, if you go and read, there's a very good piece on Heard, which I'm sure you're all regular readers of, on the Reform Party's internal sort of debates about what they do. And they're practically licking their lips at the prospects of a Labour government led by Keir Starmer, because they know full well that this will be an immense well of disaffection for them to draw upon. That's going to be challenging for us, because I don't think at this point in time, after all of us have probably spent a bit too long after Corbynism wandering around, wondering what to do with ourselves, we haven't really got ourselves into a position to be able to deal with that effectively yet. But what I can see happening over the last few months is that elements of that are starting to come together. And I think things are going to move quickly over the next 6 months or so before the election. I really do.
Okay, fantastic. And Michael, do you see any left renewal? Are you feeling renewed?
I think the British left is in, rather than a period of mourning, still in its kind of official period of moaning. The Corbynite left was a really interesting phenomenon that obviously I won't try to go into in too much detail. But on the one hand, was massive. Hundreds of thousands of people got brought into politics on sort of left-wing, social democratic, progressivist terms. They were, generally speaking, very unorganised. I mean, they came out of that political moment of the anti-austerity movement without much organisational infrastructure, failure of momentum to develop or to retain local groups. And an activist structure kind of meant that after Jeremy Corbyn lost the Labour leadership in 2019, we went back really to having this kind of disorganised soup of people who were desperately looking for answers and very, very frustrated. And basically the kind of prevailing mood on the left for some time now has been that Keir Starmer has lied to us all by winning the Labour leadership on false promises, and that he is really, really bad and smells. And that is pretty much where we've got to as a left. Where we don't have a huge amount of organisation is how are we actually going to combat that in the long run? There are a few things that are worth saying. I mean, one is that the electoral alternatives to the Labour Party are very, very, very big already. So you've already got lots of independents in various places, places like Tower Hamlets and various other spots. A Green Party that has a plausible claim on a Bristol seat. You have Jamie Driscoll running in the north of England. And as a Labour member, obviously, I have to say I would vote for the Labour Party and would never dream of voting for anyone other than the Labour Party. But you do have quite a lot of sort of left challenges. One of the dangers of Galloway, by the way, is that he kind of slips into this mix as the most successful left of Labour challenge and kind of brings around his vehicle a section, a huge section of the people who were part of that disorganised soup and are looking for an alternative. You know, left of Labour electoral alternatives tend to become a much bigger thing when Labour's in government. This is all happening before Labour is even in government. And so when Labour does get into government, I think we can expect a much more successful challenge from the left. The other thing to say is that obviously it hasn't been a completely empty few years. This has been the biggest moment of industrial unrest in recent British history, certainly this century. You've got to go back to the pensions dispute of 2012 to kind of really see anything remotely on that scale. So you have seen something else kick off. The problem there is that industrial moment of unrest, which is this kind of bipolarity between industrial and social struggle on the one hand and political projects on the other. And it kind of feels like we can only do one at a time. 5 years previous to Corbynism was all about strikes and social movements. It all then swung into the Labour Party. And then just as soon as that happened, the Labour left fell into complete disarray. There's almost no fight over the internally within the Labour Party at a grassroots level anymore, and all the way back to the streets without much in the way of political representation. The real challenge for the left over the next, not just 5 but 10 years, is to develop a mode of politics where we can have political representation for the mass movements and the growing disaffection with prevailing economic consensus and with the political establishment, including the Labour leadership, where we can create a political representation rather than an objective drag on them. And at the moment, that feels incredibly difficult. But if we don't manage it, then the anti-establishment, anti-system forces that will come out of that political moment and grab it are very dark indeed.